This video is sponsored by Squarespace. More about them in just a moment. The other day, I was laying awake in my bed, unable to get to sleep, and I began to wonder, what do you reckon are the most Googled philosophical questions? Little did I know, this innocent nighttime idea was about to ruin almost an entire week of my life. So, I'm now here to yap about it. My name is Joe Folley, and this is Unsolicited Advice. Okay, so, full disclosure, when I started this, I kind of assumed that this would be the kind of thing that somebody will have already done somewhere. I kind of thought, okay, I'm sure that if I Google what are the top 10 most Googled philosophy questions, some kind of wonderful article would emerge from the shadows and I could just credit that article and we could go through it together. It turned out to be much more difficult than that for a number of reasons. I did find one article that was kind of an approximation of this. It was from Digital Third Coast and it was sort of the top existential questions that we ask Google. And I kind of thought, okay, this will be it. This is my answer. This is wonderful. I can just go through this and get started. But I was just a little bit skeptical because there's nothing necessarily wrong with this article, but I think we may have different definitions as to what might qualify as a philosophical question. A couple of the questions that they counted as existential and thus philosophical were, what do dreams mean and why am I so tired? And it's not that there's anything wrong with asking those questions, and they certainly do impinge upon philosophy, but I don't think that they're necessarily what I would call classic philosophical questions. I couldn't sort of neatly pick out a philosophical field that they each fit into. You know, why am I so tired seems to be, you know, you could link that to existential philosophy if you wanted, but as far as I could tell, it seemed like it would more comfortably fit into a kind of psychological framework, right? If somebody's tired, they kind of probably want to just know the causal mechanisms behind that. And again, what do dreams mean? This feels more like psychoanalysis than philosophy. There were some other fun philosophical questions there, but this clued me into the fact that chances are we would have different criteria for going through Google search terms and deciding which questions count as philosophical. So my next port of call was to go through these most asked questions list, right? This sort of seemed like it was, again, like a reasonably good place to begin. And a lot of websites will compile these lists of the most Googled questions of 2024 or 2023 or whatever year happens to be most recent with complete data. So I kind of thought this would be fruitful vein of inquiry. I did get somewhere with this. There were a couple of philosophical questions on the most asked questions list, but I certainly didn't get to the top 10. At this point, it sort of dawned on me that if I wanted to discover this, I would have to go and compile the list myself. This ended up being so much more work than I anticipated that it would be. So here's roughly what I did. I want to share my methodology, my deeply unscientific methodology for how to come up with the top 10 most Googled philosophical questions. So I used a website called SEMrush. It's like a big Google Trends data compiler. So it lets you know what people are Googling based on certain keywords. And so then the question was, how do I just pick out questions? There's no way of just asking this database, what are the most Google questions? So I had to kind of do a substitute, which is that I looked up the Google searches with what, where, who, how, and why in their name and exported the top 10,000 of each of those. So I was then looking at 5 10,000 row long documents. And I thought, okay, we'll have to, somewhere in here will lie the most Googled philosophical questions. I thought, okay, this is closer than I've got before. But of course, I immediately bumped up against a further problem, which is that how on earth would I find or create a program that would be able to sort through all of this data? You know, if I do it, it's human fallibility. I'm a terrible coder, so I called up some of my more techie friends, and they sort of said that my best bet was to try and build my own large language model, which is well beyond my capabilities. So eventually, I just sort of made peace with the fact that I was going to have to read through each of these 10,000-line spreadsheets in order to pick out what the most philosophical questions of each would be. Which isn't necessarily, you know, it's not the most mentally stimulating work, but, you know, needs must. So I went back to the spreadsheets and I just kind of scrolled through each of them and picked out the top 10 out of each of those. I didn't end up having to go through 50,000 rows. I think I probably ended up going through like 30,000 and something just to make sure. I almost certainly missed some of them just because, obviously, I am fallible. I will have missed some of them out. But this is kind of the best I could do. I told you, it's not a very scientific process. I'm hoping that I just caught most of the questions. And even if there are mistakes, this is kind of a rough guide. I'm sure that there is something that passed me by when my brain had turned to mush around line 25,700 or something. But this is what I've come up with. And of course, this is all based roughly on what I define to be a philosophical question, which is a subjective statement. One of the things that I tried to do in order to check that I hadn't missed any was to go back to the database and just search key philosophical terms that I reckon would have come up a lot, things like God or nihilism or logic and stuff like that, and just see what pops up. And some of that ended up being fruitful, some of it didn't. But that's kind of roughly how I ended up with the questions that I did from this dive into Google search data. God, I cannot tell you how much this made my head hurt. Number 10, so the least popular of our list, but still very popular by search volume, is how to be happy with 14.8 thousand monthly searches, at least from the US. There's no surprises here. I mean, how to be happy, the human project of attaining happiness, is A, one of the oldest philosophical questions ever, and B, something that is immediately pertinent to people's everyday lives. I'm actually very surprised that this one wasn't higher up on the list. Just to give a kind of brief potted history of the philosophy of happiness, I suppose. Again, this is one of the oldest philosophical questions in the world. In fact, there's an ancient Egyptian vizier and one of the first philosophers ever recorded, you know, thousands of years before the birth of ancient Greek philosophy. This is in, I think, around the year 2500 BC, which is absurd. You know, think about that. That is further from the birth of Christ than we are. God, the ancient world just messes with your head, man. But it is just a tie into the broader philosophical question of how to live a good life, or to put it more classically, what is the good life? I say that ancient Egyptian philosopher is called Tahotep, and he answers this question sort of in like a reasonably expected way, right? He's talking about the responsibilities of a leader and the kind of ways that you can set up your life to be a good citizen and thus achieve some measure of self-fulfillment and self-happiness. Now, bringing this forward, just to emphasize just how big of a question this was in the ancient world, because at the moment we don't often associate how to be happy necessarily with philosophy, but classically, this is such a huge philosophical question. So the Stoics, you know, very much concerned with virtue, but they held that virtue was necessary and sufficient for fulfillment and happiness. I think that's really worth noting, you know. Whereas today we tend to think of ethics and psychological fulfillment as somewhat separate, that was not at all obvious to the ancient world. They were very much working through the framework that whatever it means to be a good person, it must also fulfill the human being emotionally. Part of a lot of the framework that these ancient Greek philosophers are working with entails that the human being has a telos or a purpose, and that in fulfilling that purpose, they will both become emotionally fulfilled, but also fulfilled in a very thick, ethical, virtuous sense. And, you know, the Stoics approach the world through that framework. The Epicureans are very concerned with happiness. Epicurus, despite his reputation as sort of a vagabond and somebody who just wants to accrue hedonistic pleasure, that's actually slander from a later Stoic author. Epicurus is very concerned with happiness, yes, and to that extent, he's a hedonist. But he's very concerned with moderation. What Epicurus thinks is that in order to gain happiness, or in order to safeguard your happiness, you ought to need as few things as possible. And he thinks there are some things that human beings necessarily need, things like food and water, and for him, friendship, which is awesome, and I think very insightful. There are many things that he calls non-natural needs or non-natural desires that we impose upon the world. You know, we think, oh, I need this fast car. It's like a kind of classroom example of that kind of thing. But for Epicurus, this obviously didn't include fast cars, and certainly didn't just include fast cars, though that would fall into his camp were he alive today. Epicurus did all sorts of things. You know, he lived very simply. He mainly consumed bread and watered down wine, and apparently a luxury for him was like a bit of cheese and a bit of meat. Yeah, that's far more frugal than most people live. Even more out there schools like cynicism. You know, most of us will have heard of Diogenes the Cynic, the guy that's lived in a jar and spurned all comfort. He kind of pressed himself up against cold statues in winter and burnt himself in the summer. And it's very easy to see this as a kind of masochistic enterprise, but Diogenes himself was very concerned with human happiness. He thought that human beings getting closer to their natural state was the best way to become both free and happy. don't know, in some sense it shows just how little human concerns have moved. We ultimately still are asking the same questions now. How can I be happy? How do I live a fulfilled and good life? And I think that's wonderful. But before moving on, I just want to take a quick moment to thank today's sponsor, Squarespace. If you're looking to build a website, then you know it can be a real hassle. First, you have to choose a domain name and then design the whole thing. And there's always this underlying fear that you're messing up and creating something that doesn't just look untidy, but actually looks unprofessional. But this is where Squarespace comes into play. They take all of that complexity and compress it down into a single platform, using ready-made templates to take all of that stress and headache out of website building. Their block-based Fluid Engine editing system is also so easy to use and makes it simple to integrate anything you want into your website without having to master an elaborate coding language. Head to squarespace.com/unsolicitedadvice and use the code unsolicitedadvice to get 10% off your first purchase of a website or a domain name. But anyway, back to the video. But next up, at number 9, with 22.2 thousand monthly searches, is how do you know? So I was very surprised by this. I kind of thought that ethical and existential questions would kind of dominate this list, and they really haven't. I certainly didn't expect there to be such a classic epistemological question right there at number 9, so above how to be happy. You know, we think of happiness as a very primary human concern, whereas knowledge, at the very least, thinking abstractly about knowledge, you might not expect people to come up with that much, and certainly not choose to ask Google about it. But no, 22.2 thousand searches per month on how do you know? And reflecting on this again, I suppose it is actually a question of profound practical importance. You know, we think a lot about concepts of misinformation and stuff now. A lot of that, or a lot of the potentially the answer behind worries about this sort of thing, is found in epistemology. And I'm not necessarily thinking about large abstract epistemic philosophy, things like, you know, defining knowledge, although that's its own interesting question. But things like, what is a reliable belief formation mechanism, I think is an incredibly handy and useful philosophical question that many people have worked very hard on. Interestingly, I think some of the best work in this style of epistemology, specifically answering this question, how do you know, actually occurs in the philosophy of science, because I kind of broadly construed the scientific method, might come on to that later, is possibly the most successful human invention ever. It's just unimaginably brilliant. So a lot of our thinking about what forms reliable belief formation processes is looking at science and then thinking, right, why does that work? What about that leads to that? You know, this is the kind of thinking behind all sorts of things, thinking behind inductive logics. Carnap tried to create an inductive logic, and many people have followed in his footsteps. But you know, to bring this slightly more abstract, we can also interpret this question, how do you know, as, again, a slightly more classically philosophical concern, which is, where does knowledge come from? Most of us will have inherited a kind of loose empiricism about this. Because we live in a kind of post-Enlightenment world, a lot of us will tacitly think that, okay, knowledge at base level comes from our senses. You know, we observe the world around us, or the phenomenal world around us, if you want to be strict about it, and we come to conclusions about what kind of observations we're going to see in the future. But ultimately, things bottom out at observation. But it is an open question whether that's true. One way of thinking about this is, where do you think the laws of logic come from? One potential answer you can give is that we observe regularities in the world around us. But how do we derive those regularities? In order to have observed regularities in the world around us and to come up with these logical laws based on observation, we will have needed to have a prior logic working implicitly or innately in order to draw those inferences from observations to general patterns. There is, you know, I think a very interesting kind of argument that suggests that certain very, very fundamental vectors of knowledge might not be empirical. They might actually just be built in. The reason that I think that's such an interesting and potentially profound philosophical point is that if that is true, and I say, I'm not suggesting that it necessarily is, but I'm suggesting that this is a position worth taking seriously. Pairing that with naturalism, this idea that humans are, you know, evolved creatures. We have come to our particular cognitive faculties and apparatuses through a linear causal process of natural selection. If those two things are true, that we've got certain cognitive architecture baked in, certain like laws of logic baked in at the start, and it might just be a very minimal logic, and also that it's been baked in by a kind of irrational causal process, natural selection, Then some people have argued, I think C.S. Lewis has argued this most famously, but it has been argued by Swinburne as well. There is an open question about whether, under naturalism, without adding an extra thing in, we can trust our laws of logic to tell us about the actual world, as opposed to the world as it simply filters in through our particular cognitive architecture. And, you know, it's an open question also whether that's a problem. You might, from one perspective, say, okay, yeah, fine, we can only draw inferences between observations, and to a certain extent, we're just kind of projecting our cognitive architecture out on the world, but we can never step outside that anyway, so it ultimately doesn't matter. But from another perspective, someone might say, okay, that's fine, but you've kind of trapped us all in this skeptical scenario where we can't know anything about the external world, and that itself seems worrying. And I'll leave that up to you to discuss in the comments, because I think there are, I go back and forth on this, but I lean more towards a sort of trapped in our own observations, but that's okay kind of standpoint. I'm a bit of a pragmatist about a lot of things. That is inevitably where I would end up falling. But no, I was just very interested that How Do You Know was number 9. I expected there to be no philosophy of knowledge and no epistemology on this list whatsoever. I know, I'm very thrilled that How Do You Know has made the cut. Moving on to number 8, what is the meaning of life, with 22,200 monthly searches? I wasn't particularly surprised by this one. I remember speaking to a member of my old faculty, and she said that whenever she told anyone that she was an academic philosopher, they would always, or almost always, reply with this question. Oh, you're an academic philosopher. Tell me what the meaning of life is. And it used to drive her absolutely bananas. So I'm not surprised that it's shown up here. I am surprised that it's so low. I mean, number 8, we've got 7 more asked philosophical questions than this. What is the meaning of life is one of those questions that I think I've talked about this before, but I think that the grammar of the question tricks us into analyzing it potentially unhelpfully. So what is the meaning of life? That word meaning, when it's embedded in a sentence in that way, it makes it look like meaning is an object out in the world and we're going to go and find it. Like, what is the meaning of life? There is a meaning out there. We're looking for it. Have we found it? Is it not there? In which case, life is meaningless. And that might be technically true. Like, that could be a reasonable line of argument. At the same time, we've got to think about whether this framing, whereby we see meaning as an object in the world that we ought to go and find, is the correct one, is the one that we care about. Because if you rephrase questions like, what is the meaning of life, into questions that I think cash out in roughly the same pragmatic way, but don't involve this kind of object-oriented framing, the question becomes a lot more tractable. So rather than asking what is the meaning of life, which can sound like it's dipping its toe into metaphysics, it sounds like we might conclude that there is no meaning and that then we would fall into despair, I prefer to ask questions like, what motivates us? Like, just on a kind of empirical and factual level, what motivates us? What are the kind of things that empirically bring existential fulfillment? Partly because I think those are interesting questions in their own right. Something that I have always been quite taken with, and is a theme in parts of Nietzsche's work, is that it could be that, at least for a lot of people, what leads to a fulfilling life might involve believing false things. It might be that in order to make life bearable, there is some kind of fiction that at the very least most people might need to view the world through. I think that's really interesting. The other thing that this experiential-based framework allows you to do is sort of ask things like, well, why do people come to have different meanings of life? We all tend to agree, at the very least, that what fulfills one person existentially might not fulfill another person existentially. For example, I have a friend of mine who is a devout Catholic, and he said on multiple occasions that without his map of the world grounding out in teleological intelligence in the way that it does, if you're a devout theist, he would really struggle to find things that naturally motivate him. He would struggle to value things. For whatever reason, be it psychological or philosophical, in order for him to value things, he deeply needs to believe that it reflects some kind of metaphysical base-level teleology. And I think that a lot of people don't have that. I actually think this is behind a lot of the reason why theists and non-theists come to such blows over the significance of God. Because I think for a lot of theists, it's very difficult to imagine how somebody could perceive their lives as full without God. And I think for a lot of atheists, it's very difficult to imagine someone who, I say needs, because needs sounds like it's kind of a weakness. I don't necessarily think it is. But someone who needs to tie their personal values to something more teleological and metaphysical. And this is aside from any kind of philosophical concerns about value variance and whether we're all going to fall into moral subjectivism or something like that. But I do think that this idea of, instead of asking what is the meaning of life, asking something like, how do humans end up having experiences of meaning, I think just may make the question a little bit more tractable. And at the very least, if you're a naturalist, this is going to make the question, I think, a lot more tractable. If you are a theist, or in other ways inclined towards metaphysics and also teleologically infused metaphysics, I think that you can be a lot more bullish with questions like, what is the meaning of life, with that framing of meaning is a thing out there and I need to go find it. If you're not, I think that asking questions like, what is the meaning of life, is likely to lead you down dead ends. For those of you that want to explore this further, there's a fantastic introductory book by Walter Kaufmann called Existentialism from Dostoevsky to Sartre, which was one of the first books on existentialism that I read, and I think it's fantastic. I still think it's a fantastic introductory book. It introduces you to loads of different thinkers in pretty quick succession, but Kaufmann writes an introduction to each excerpt. He also gives you an idea of the kind of totality of each thinker's thoughts, which is really helpful. And Kaufmann, as always, has an absolutely fantastically clear presentation of everything, because he's a brilliant thinker and a brilliant writer, and I'm terribly jealous of it. But anyway, on to question 7, what is the scientific method? I was so surprised that this ranked so highly. This was at 27,100 monthly Googles. And I suppose on reflection, maybe I should be less surprised by this. After all, as we were talking about earlier, the scientific method is possibly humanity's greatest achievement, or at least it's definitely up there, right? I suppose it's unsurprising that people would want to know what the scientific method is. And this is, unsurprisingly, the domain of the philosophy of science. There are many different angles you can approach this question from. First thing is that a lot of people tend to think what is the scientific method is a question with a single answer. And you can see why that is, right? I think that to a certain extent, we all have a picture of science in our head that is slightly idealized, especially if, like myself, you're not a working scientist. This illusion for me was shattered when I started talking to working scientists, and I was just sort of asking, oh, like, what do you do? Like, what does your method actually look like? And it looks pretty different from the kind of idealized models that crop up in a lot of early 20th century philosophy of science. A classic early 20th century answer to what is the scientific method is something like Popperism. And, you know, Karl Popper's an absolute genius in all sorts of ways. I think his work is brilliant. And is sort of still this absolute giant in the philosophy of science. A lot of philosophy of science still is in dialogue with Popper, even though, you know, most people don't agree with his views as he put them. Popper, of course, based the scientific method on falsificationism. So he thought that a scientific statement must be, at least in principle, falsifiable, which, like, totally makes sense as a criterion. Right? There are two different ways that people have critiqued this. One is to point to examples of things that we class as science, but might not be falsifiable in quite the way that Popper wants. Two kind of classic examples of this are string theory, which is notoriously sort of very hard to give empirical evidence for and against, because it's just such advanced mathematics and seems so detached from the world of everyday experience. It's very difficult to see what would confirm it and also what would disconfirm it. Another example is evolutionary psychology, right? By its very nature, evolutionary psychology is a sort of backwards-looking thing. It's attempting to see what frameworks we have now, psychologically, by observation, and that bit's perfectly falsifiable. And then it's trying to construct an evolutionary story of how it got there. And there are parts of evolutionary psychology that certainly are falsifiable. So, I know, what's a good one? Like, you might predict that men are attracted to women with wider hips, right? On the basis that, I don't know, maybe that's an indicator of fertility or something. And you could, in theory, test that, right? One of the difficulties of testing it is there are so many social and cultural factors kind of in between you and the causal effect of those evolutionary pressures. But you can test some of that. The thing that's more difficult to test is the further claim that this came about because of particular evolutionary pressures. Because by its very nature, at the very least, that's not like a law that you can then take out in the world and test in quite the neat way that you can test whether, I don't know, birds can remember roots, or you can test certain predictions from models of gravitational theory and stuff like that. You know, it's a little bit less of a clear-cut example of a falsifiable hypothesis. That's very interesting, because intuitively, people get skeptical about evolutionary psychology. It doesn't seem obvious to me that it's definitely not science. And so that does throw some doubt onto Popper's falsifiability criterion. Another reason that you might want to move beyond Popper himself to answer this question, what is the scientific method, is because of that point that I was talking about before with regards to the idealization of scientific inquiry. One of the things that I noticed, and this isn't just an observation by me, I think Lakatos made something like this observation, is that when these philosophers talk to working scientists and just say, like, give me a causal account of what your method is, it tends to be much less neat than people would initially think. You also find this with mathematicians, right? We tend to, in the philosophy of mathematics and just like reflecting on mathematics more generally, sometimes we can get it into our heads that, you know, when people are proving mathematical theorems, what's happening is that they'll start with their assumptions and then they will just prove things down. And they will eventually end up at their theorem and they'll go, right, that's fantastic. But of course, if you talk to mathematicians, that's not what happens at all. One of my very good friends is a working mathematician in general relativity theory. I once asked him, you know, what does your proof structure look like? And he sort of looks at me and he goes, well, Joe, I have a hunch. And then I try and work out what the hunch is for a very long time. And then eventually I prove the hunch. And that hunch bit, that kind of initial intuition, that's not something that's very well captured by very idealized models of scientific inquiry, because that's just like, that's a shot in the dark, right? It's hypothesis formation, but it's not just any hypothesis formation. It is non-computational hypothesis formation that seems to strike mathematicians and scientists out of the blue. So if you're going to answer the question, what is the scientific method? That's going to have to be a big part of your story. And it's why I think it's one of the most exciting frontiers in the philosophy of science today. Okay, next up at number 6, we have what to do. I was kind of on the fence about whether to include this as a philosophical question because it is just very broad. I mean, there is something almost quite comic about the idea of somebody asking Google just what to do. Like, no kind of clarification as to what the situation is or what they're looking to get out of their actions. Just like, what to do, broadly construed. But I suppose, yeah, that is a moral and existential question, right? From one perspective, we've got what to do as interpreted, what should I do? Which, again, I think this ties back to our question about ethics earlier, which is, people want some kind of moral guidance, and philosophy has historically provided that. And we've gone through quite a lot of that. It's one of the oldest philosophical questions in the book. And also, dovetailing with our prior discussion about what is the meaning of life, I think that in some ways, what to do is a more helpful framing of existential matters. What should I do? How should I feel? As we're saying before, we can lose some of that action-oriented component when it comes to asking these questions. So yeah, I actually quite like this, even though I was on the fence about whether to include it as a philosophical question. That makes a lot of sense. I mean, again, I'm not massively sure that Google's going to provide the answers that you seek, but maybe philosophy will. Or at least philosophy will help you find those answers for yourself. I've always been quite taken by Jean-Paul Sartre's idea that there might be moral quandaries that are, at least in practice, completely insoluble for the person acting. And it is in resolving those irresolvable ethical difficulties that person part discovers, but also part crafts who they are. So his example is, during the Second World War, this person lives in occupied France, and they're debating whether to go and join the French resistance fighting the Nazis, which you might initially think, oh yeah, that sounds like a really good thing to do, but he's going to leave his elderly mother, and he's her only joy in life. In some variants of this that I've seen told in classrooms, the mother is sick, but I don't think that is in Sartre's version. In Existentialism is Humanism, and according to him, it's a quandary that a student brought to him, so at the very least it's not in Sartre's version. And Sartre's point is that it's very difficult for an abstract theory to come up with a definite solution to this, right? Because the choice is so complicated. On the one hand, you've got a potentially huge moral gain kicking the Nazis out of France, or at least helping to kick the Nazis out of France. But on the other hand, that good is not necessarily certain at that point, right? This is while France is being occupied, so there's no guarantee it's going to pay off. And are you ever justified in inflicting that level of distress on your own mother? Do you have any special duties towards her? I really like this as a moral dilemma. Well, look, there are strengths to moral dilemmas like the trolley problem and these sorts of toy problems, they're sometimes called. The trolley problem is one of them. They also come up in sort of like the, Judith Jarvis Thompson is brilliant at coming up with very, very abstract ethical dilemmas that nonetheless do impinge on something specific within a debate. Like, she has loads around like abortion, and they involve things like expanding babies, and there's the violinist argument, which people may have already heard of. But one of the reasons that I like Sartre's moral dilemma here is because it isn't contrived. And, you know, the contrived nature of Judith Jarvis Thompson's thought experiments are the point. They're meant to isolate different bits of your moral intuition. But nonetheless, I like the fact that Sartre's student dilemma doesn't do this and actually really gets across just how agonizing a question like what to do is. I suppose I shouldn't be surprised that 27,100 people search that a month. Again, I just think that there's something very funny about, I mean, you must be pretty desperate to Google just what to do. But anyway, moving on. Number five is What is Philosophy? Again, with 27,100 monthly searches. And I'm kind of surprised that this was on the list. I figured that What is Philosophy is kind of an abstract, like meta-philosophical question. But I imagine that a fair amount of the searches here were just like, weren't asking what is philosophy in a philosophical sense. They were just saying, you know, what is philosophy? Like, I've heard this word. I kind of have an idea of roughly what it refers to, but I need some more detail. I imagine that might have been the driving impetus behind searching it, because I can't imagine that many people are interested in the meta-philosophical debate around the definition of philosophy. Nonetheless, I do think that that is an interesting debate. There's sort of a long tradition of philosophers calling one another not real philosophers. One of the things that Diogenes criticized Plato for was not being a sufficient philosophical heir to Socrates, because Diogenes is also heavily influenced by Socrates, at least, you know, as far as we know. Whatever we say about these ancient lives is always a little bit spotty. But as far as we know, Diogenes really was heavily influenced by Socrates. And the reason that Diogenes criticized Plato, or one of the reported reasons, was that he thought Plato didn't take the lived aspect of Socrates's questioning seriously, whereas Diogenes would badger people on the street and live as a mendicant and would, in his view, emulate what Socrates acted like far better than Plato, and arguably took it one step further. You know, I mean, Socrates didn't charge for lessons, but I don't know Socrates's economic situation, but I don't think he lived in a jar like Diogenes. So that's just to demonstrate that the debate around who's a real philosopher, what is philosophy, what counts as philosophy, is almost as old as philosophy itself. Of course, you know, the word just means a love of wisdom, but that is just a profoundly unhelpful definition, because you have to ask what love is and what wisdom is and what constitutes loving wisdom. So if anything, it asks more questions than it answers. Then maybe that is appropriate for a definition of philosophy. This tradition of, you know, having a go at other people for not being real philosophers continues well into the 20th century. At the beginning of the 20th century, especially in the Anglo-American world, people became very interested in what counts as a real issue or a real statement, or what kind of topics are worthy and deserving of philosophical inquiry. And famously, the Vienna Circle and A.J. Ayres, kind of the English representative, I suppose, of the Vienna Circle, though I don't think he was ever kind of like a full-fledged member. But, you know, people like Carnap and Mack and Schlick, you know, these kinds of thinkers were concerned with the idea that philosophy was wasting its time asking pseudo-questions. At least on Ayres' formulation, he thought the job of philosophy was to logically elucidate concepts, and the job of empirical inquiry was to discover matters of fact about the world. And thus he thought that fields like metaphysics, well, especially metaphysics, but to a lesser extent, fields like ethics and aesthetics, were not properly philosophical. They're doing something else. And the reason why he goes so hard on metaphysics, far harder than he goes on ethics, and far harder than he goes on aesthetics, is because he sees metaphysics as pretending to uncover truths about the world, but in fact not. He sees it as not necessarily dishonest, but at the very least, selling itself far higher than it actually is worth. And I have a blog post about this, because sometimes Ayres is misinterpreted as saying that any statement that isn't verifiable or true by definition is actually meaningless. But the term he uses is literally significant, and he's using that as a kind of term of art to clarify what kinds of questions are fruitful for philosophers to inquire into. All of that is just to say that the question of what is philosophy has History as old as philosophy itself, and has continued in earnest well into the 20th century and well into the present day. People still debate back and forth whether metaphysics is worth doing or what the right way to do ethics is, and whether things like intuitions should be taken as data for philosophical inquiry, because on the face of it, you know, especially metaphysics, people rely on intuitions quite a lot, the idea of this is intuitive, this is unintuitive. But there's real questions like, why would we think that intuition is an overwhelmingly good guide to truth, especially when so many scientific and mathematical discoveries are praised precisely because of their unintuitive nature? So yeah, that's another example of how this question of what is philosophy, what should be incorporated into the philosophical process, is somewhat of a never-ending debate in philosophy. And, you know, you could argue this happens with quite a lot of fields. What is music is as old as the study of music, and what is science is as old as the study of science. And fields like to reflect upon themselves. And I know that's nice. It's not necessarily something that I massively concern myself with, because I'm less concerned with whether something actually is philosophy than whether it is helpful to answer whatever particular question has taken my fancy. But yeah, I do think this is a very interesting question. And yeah, number five on our list. Coming in at number four, we have, is God real? With 33,100 monthly searches. Again, I wasn't particularly surprised by this. This is a question that I think gets many people into philosophy. I think that most people in the world are raised in some kind of religious tradition. And if that's something that they become invested in intellectually, either they will begin to question the truth of that religion, in which case philosophy of religion is knocking on their door, or they'll want to explore that religion further, in which case theology, and thus the philosophy of religion, is also knocking on their door. I've always wondered to what degree philosophy of religion and this question of is God real, and if so, what is his nature, what percentage of kind of popular philosophical discussions are taken up with this question? Because apart from ethics, I can't imagine that there are many that are as dominant as this question of God's existence and God's nature. And that makes a lot of sense because of the sheer number of people that are raised in different religious traditions. It's apparently quite controversial to say this as a sort of agnostic, but I actually think that the question of God's existence and the issues around God's existence are incredibly fascinating. I still find new things to discover about the nature of God's existence and the truth or potential truth of God's existence years after first picking up a philosophy of religion textbook. You know, I had a new atheist phase, I had a Christian phase, and I was sort of 13, 14, I suddenly became very devout, and then I became an atheist. You know how it goes. You're a teenager, you leap between positions incredibly recklessly, and eventually I've settled on a kind of loose agnosticism that hopefully will one day get resolved in either direction. So yeah, I'm not surprised that this made it so far up this list. I do think it's a very important question, and I do think it's a question we can make progress on. There was a while ago, I think less so now, it was very common for people to decry the question of God's existence as either unimportant or insignificant, or like the kind of thing that only fools would think about. And I'm kind of glad we're past that, partly because I just think that it's a question that naturally animates people if they've been raised in a religious tradition. This is what the question of God's existence does for me. It's a philosophical question that at once talks about the metaphysical, which is something that I very rarely am that interested in. But it attempts to make the metaphysical relevant to the linear causal chain of my life, because it impinges on notions of the afterlife and on morality and on, you know, miracles. Like this is kind of a pet hobby of mine more than anything, but studying purported miracles historically is just an absolutely fascinating rabbit hole to go down, because some of them are notoriously difficult to give naturalistic explanations for. Probably the most famous one is the miracle of the sun. On Substack a few weeks ago, this became like a huge topic of discourse, but the miracle of the sun, or Our Lady of Fatima, is so fascinating if you ever want to go digging into it. All of the kind of archives for that are basically publicly available. Just historical miracles like that, I think, are so fascinating to dive into. And yeah, I don't know, it keeps my interest in the philosophy of religion alive, partly because, again, I'm less interested in the purely metaphysical, but religious claims are meant to be the metaphysical made manifest. And I think that's fascinating. I think it's part of why people find it so gripping, apart from any kind of historically contingent reasons to do with being raised in a religious faith. On number three, we have, what is love? And we've got a big leap in searches here. Our last one, God is Real, was 33,100 monthly searches. This is 60,500 monthly searches. So an enormous leap from number 4 to number 3. This one took me by surprise, but in hindsight, I really don't think it ought to have taken me by surprise. I mean, the question of love is probably one of the most important questions that any of us will ever ask ourselves, just because whatever form love comes in, be it platonic or romantic or what have you, familial. I mean, this isn't empirical, this is just anecdotal, but most people seem to rank it as among the most important things in their life. You know, if you do, you know, actually to touch upon empirical data, one of the biggest predictors of somebody's long-term happiness is how the quality of their relationship with their partner is. And an extraordinarily accurate predictor of mortality is how many close relationships someone has. You know, the question of love, again, I think it's very interesting because it's very easy for philosophical debates around love to get very, very wooey, and I don't want to say abstract. It's not even that it's abstract. It just becomes very vague because we're all trying to describe and hit upon a feeling and type of relationship, not necessarily a romantic relationship, but any loving relationship that most people have experienced. At least I hope you've experienced it. But at the same time, it's notoriously difficult to put into words. It's like the paradigm example of something that is difficult to put into words. If you were to ask the average person on the street, name something that's very difficult to put into words, I would bet you 50 quid, in theory, that they would say love, because it is famously unfathomable. So yes, I suppose I shouldn't really be surprised. Who's tried to give different definitions of love? Well, Aristotle's definition of friendliness, which is sometimes extended to an idea of love, maybe it was extended by later Christian thinkers. But Aristotle's definition of friendliness and friendship was wishing the good of the other for their own sakes. That was to kind of differentiate it from attempting to use someone, right? Like you might enjoy someone's company, but that doesn't necessarily mean that you love them. You might enjoy their company an awful lot, but if push came to shove, you wouldn't act in their best interests for their own sake, then Aristotle would say that you're not truly friends with that person, and then that has ended up meaning that you wouldn't love that person, according to the kind of either Aristotle, if that's just a quirk of the translation I'm using, that it's translated as friendliness rather than love, or later thinkers, if they were building on Aristotle. I think that Aquinas certainly does define love as wishing the good of the other for their own sake. I can't remember if he's just talking about God's love, or if he's talking about human love as well. You might be talking about both. I don't know. I'm just talking off the top of my head here. A really interesting book on love, if you want to answer this question, what is love, is by Simon May. And it might just be called Love, A History. I'm going to Google this because otherwise I'm just going to mess it up. Yes, it is Love, A History. Absolutely fantastic. It goes all the way from, like, I'm going to do a video on it at some point. Because it's brilliant, and I one of the best books on love I've ever read. It goes all the way from Plato to Proust, which is amazing. I mean, that's 2,000 years, over 2,000 years, 2,500 years of studying this concept. Reading that book really put the importance of what is love in perspective for me. It's one of those aspects of human life that you cannot help but feel is important, right? One of the paradigm examples of an aspect of human life that you can't help but feel is important is pain. I can say that I don't care about anything all I want, but if you were to take like a hot piece of iron and press it on my arm, I could not help but care about that. The value is imposed on me as if from without. I think that kind of experience is fascinating. We all agree that things like pain are subjective, and we all agree that things like love are, to a certain extent, subjective, right? Famously, love is person-dependent. I don't even know what a non-person-dependent love would look like. And yet, it forces its own importance on us. There's something about our internal constitution, our collection of drives, as Nietzsche might say, that seems to find love something it's almost impossible not to value. And that kind of thing, I think, is amazing. And I also think that it's a wonderful counterpoint to the example of pain, because just pain's very unpleasant. But love is wonderful and gripping, naturally gripping, in a way that is undeniable. And I love how much that contrasts with just how difficult it is to pin down the concept. So yeah, that's kind of my book recommendation for this question is Love, A History by Simon May, because that really helps clarify some of my thinking on love. The other thinker that I adore on love, and I've mentioned this on the channel before, is Stendhal, because his book on love is really good for sort of deromanticizing love. And I don't mean that in a bad way. I don't think that Stendhal has like a horribly cynical view of love or anything like that, although he is probably more cynical than most. But he kind of brings it down to earth. He naturalizes love. I think one of the things that we're currently missing in our conception of love, is an idea of love that is both sufficiently, I don't want to say idealistic, because I feel like that's implicitly insulting, but sufficiently romantic and compelling that our concept of love still captures that inherently motivational and valuing aspect to it. But at the same time, it's not so away with the fairies that it completely loses touch with reality, right? It's very easy for our concepts of love to become so narrativized that, you know, we consign it to the storybooks or the Disney films, and then we go out into the world and we find that these myths about love are false myths, like the eternal one that is made for you. And then we are disappointed. We become nihilists because we've been disenchanted with this idea. And that's why I think it's so important to think about love, is because it is one of the most important aspects of each person's life by their own report. And yet at the same time, I think it's very easy for a faulty concept of love to make that aspect of life much more difficult than it necessarily needs to be. So yes, I'm not surprised on reflection that this has come so high, even though I was surprised when I first saw it. Number two, what happens when you die? So we touched upon this in the Is God Real bit. This has 60,500 monthly searches. Yeah, I'm not surprised by this at all. What happens when you die? It's possibly one of the most practical philosophical questions, in the sense that it directly impinges on your eternity. I mean, what could be more important? I'm very much not surprised. It's also just one of the great mysteries of life, right? You know, what happens after you die? It's a place that no one has ever observed, but nonetheless is of practical import to us. Most of the time, if you can't see something and you will never see something, it doesn't matter to you, because we live in the world of phenomenal perception. But the question of the afterlife bridges that gap in a similar way that God does, right? It makes the unobservable relevant to you. I imagine that's part of why it so captures people's imagination. Obviously, there are so many approaches to answering this question. The major world religions give an awful lot, but I remember this book on the afterlife and the philosophy around the afterlife, and the first page basically said, by the end of this book, you should be convinced that in a few short decades, you will cease to be. Whatever is you will no longer exist. And I remember thinking, that's such a cool opening to an academic philosophy book, man. That's absolutely awesome. I can see how this has captured people so much. And there is probably less writing on this in academic philosophy than you would expect, considering just how much it captures people. I imagine that's probably because it is basically an intractable question. There is just no way of getting data. I mean, you can maybe turn to near-death experiences, but that's fraught with its own epistemic concerns. And importantly, it's near death. It's not actual death. I think a really interesting perspective on the question, what happens when you die, is the Theravada Buddhist one. There, the sort of aim is to cease to exist, to be released from samsara, the world of change and suffering, but not going on to some kind of eternal afterlife in the way that you might in an Abrahamic faith. Instead, you just cease to be. Like, the goal of Theravada Buddhism is to cease to exist. And I love that. I think that's such an amazingly cool perspective, and one that is not necessarily one that you would encounter if you simply looked at the Abrahamic faiths when you're asking the question, what happens when you die? So before we go to number one, I've got some honorable mentions. Two here are, why is the sky blue? I thought, that's almost like the stereotypical question that like a toddler asks you, like, why is the sky blue? I didn't include it because ultimately I thought, that's more of a scientific question, right? We could talk about the philosophy of color vision, but ultimately I think that when someone asks why is the sky blue, they're normally looking for a purely scientific or material explanation. And the other one, which came up on the article about existential questions that are most Googled, was, is hot dog a sandwich? So I wasn't quite sure what to say on that. It only got 14,800 monthly searches, so it didn't quite crack the top 10. I suppose one interesting philosophical issue that is hot dog a sandwich elucidates is this kind of old Platonic idea of definitions, where you come up with necessary and sufficient definitions that cover all cases, that sort everything into A or not A, don't necessarily work for our kind of everyday speech. And I think is hot dog a sandwich actually illustrates that point quite well. You could almost fit it into Wittgenstein's philosophical investigations as an illustration of how the boundaries around family resemblance terms are a little bit fuzzy. And lastly, the most Googled philosophical question of last year, with 90,500 monthly searches, was, What is AI? Now, this isn't a classic philosophical question, and on reflection, I don't think we should be surprised to learn this. I mean, 2024, things like ChatGPT and large language models, they were really kind of starting to make an appearance, I suppose. And it's understandable that people would like to know what this thing that we've begun to call AI is. So I suppose I imagine that a certain number of these queries wouldn't have been going into this question with philosophy in mind. But nonetheless, as I've discussed on the channel before, this has unavoidable philosophical components to it. For instance, let's take the name, for example, artificial intelligence. Well, what is intelligence? We have operationalized definitions that we use when we study people or animals in controlled experimental environments, but a lot of those are deeply anthropomorphized, so transferring them to an artificial situation is at the very least a non-trivial task. Do we judge an artificial intelligence's intelligence on the same standards as we judge human intelligence? It's not immediately clear why that would be. After all, we don't judge an octopus on exactly the same metrics as we would judge a human regarding intelligence. Peter Godfrey-Smith has a really interesting book about this, if anyone's interested. It's called Other Minds. Very good, very readable. This is highly transferable to the world of AI, this kind of idea that, well, maybe intelligence will look very, very different depending on what type of body it inhabits. And AI has a very strange kind of body, if you can call it that, right? It's circuitry and neural networks and I don't know. I think that the philosophical component of the question, what is AI, is to a certain extent kind of underexplored. I think this is partly because philosophers are quite slow to move on things. There's been a lot of work on the question of establishing whether, in principle, an AI could have consciousness. And people go back and forth on this. But a lot of materialist philosophers are quite happy for at least the possibility of an artificial consciousness and thus an artificial intelligence. You will hear responses about that from people that think, no, there is a kind of irreducible biological component to intelligence or consciousness or something like that. But I would kind of broadly say that that's probably the minority opinion. Most philosophers, especially naturalist or materialist philosophers, are happy for AI to be possible in principle. However, and I like to say this whenever I talk about AI, because AI is currently so closely linked to large language models, that large language models just are not conscious. They don't have anything like the kind of internal architecture that we would expect from something that could approximate a type of consciousness. You know, I mean, you could challenge that position, but again, I'm just telling you the kind of majority view among people that do study large language models. Because I think it is, you know, worth noting that. However, we forget that AI, kind of machine learning, general kind of self-developing algorithms, I suppose, might be one kind of very broad word for it. Things like reinforcement algorithms, machine learning, etc., etc., etc. They're far broader than large language models. I mean, it wasn't so long ago that when somebody said AI and talked about, you know, advances in AI, they were talking about things like disease detection and machine learning to use in medical environments. And that's still a huge part of artificial intelligence as a research field. So, you know, we ought not to just equate AI with large language models. Something that a lot of neuroscientists and psychologists who work in what's called embodied cognition have pointed out, that a large amount of what would plausibly constitute artificial intelligence and artificial consciousness is going to depend on how we embody that AI. So yeah, I think this is a very interesting philosophical question, partly because it is still in its infancy. I'll just leave you on a final point, which comes from Eric Schwitzgebel, which is on the subject of AI consciousness. Schwitzgebel has currently in drafts a whole book on AI, which I haven't read yet, but I highly recommend that people check out. Anything that Schwitzgebel writes is normally fantastic. One of the most interesting thought experiments he has regarding AI and artificial consciousness is that whatever we think about the point at which artificial intelligence or artificial consciousness becomes possible, like at what point that we could reasonably conclude that an artificial thing is conscious, we at the very least need to agree on a point where we start to give plausibly artificially conscious things rights and legal protections. Because his point is that when it comes to AI, humans are faced with a very tricky philosophical dilemma, because when we're talking to one another, and to a certain extent talking to animals, we can kind of make an analogy between our own consciousness and theirs, right? Rightly or wrongly, that seems to be a big part of how we conclude that other human beings are conscious, and to a lesser extent, other human animals are conscious. I don't mean that animals are necessarily less conscious, just that that mechanism might be less of a big deal. I'm kind of talking off the top of my head here. However, artificial intelligence might not work through that same mechanism. We might not be able to intuitively know or intuitively have an estimated guess on when it can feel and when it can think, and thus when it plausibly should be afforded some kind of legal protection. Schwitzgebel's point is this: we spend a lot of time thinking about the potentials of artificial superintelligences to end the world, and that's all well and good, but we should be just as worried, or maybe not just as worried, but we should also be worried about the prospect that we won't know when a given artificial thing has consciousness. And again, it's worth saying we're probably a long way off that point. But if we don't decide when we're going to make that conclusion, we could end up really horribly abusing these conscious beings. And Schwitzgebel is very worried about that potentiality. And I kind of think I am as well. I just wanted to end on that point, because I think that when people Google what is AI, they might not necessarily realize just the philosophical can of worms that they're opening up. And I think this will be some very exciting philosophy done in the future around artificial consciousness and artificial intelligence. For example, sorry, I know I said I was going to end on the Schwitzgebel point. I'm actually going to end on this point. In the 19th century, one of the things that really changed the way that humans conceived of themselves was that we went from seeing ourselves as kind of planted down from above by God as fully formed conscious beings, as instead, you know, through theories of evolution, we began to see ourselves more like continuous animals with the rest of the animal kingdom. And that was an enormous shift in the way that we conceive of the human being. We have still been able to comfort ourselves with the fact that we are the most intelligent and the most cognitively sophisticated of the beings that we know exist. Artificial superintelligence could change that. And separate from any material worries, how is that going to affect the way that human beings conceive of themselves and conceive of what it means to be valuable and human? There's a rich philosophical history of conceiving of the human being as a rational animal, or in some way appealing to the exceptional nature of human mental properties as a way of specializing us, making us stand apart from the rest of the animals, especially in the wake of Darwin's theory of evolution by natural selection. And the prospect of artificial general intelligence and artificial superintelligence could change all of that. We might have to rethink the very thing that we tend to appeal to justify human specialness or human exceptionalism. That also sounds like an incredibly daunting, but also incredibly interesting philosophical task. It's not every day that you have to completely redefine your notion of the human and reconceptualize what it means to be a person. And we might have to do that. How terrifying and how exciting. So that's all I have for you today. I hope you enjoyed this, and I hope you enjoyed my frustrating story at the beginning. If you want to check out some more of my casual videos, I've got my Philosophical Paradoxes iceberg right here. Thank you so much for watching, and have a wonderful day.